Cave of the Ancients by Tuesday Lovesang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend, November 2016. Chapter 10. The teacher was in a bad mood. Perhaps his tea had been too cold. Perhaps his sampa had not been roasted or mixed exactly to his liking. The teacher was in a bad mood. We boys sat in the classroom, just about shivering with fright. Already he had pounced unexpectedly upon boys to my right and boys to my left. My memory was good. I knew the lessons perfectly. I could repeat chapter and verse from any part of the 108 volumes of the Kangiyur. Thwack, thwack! I jumped about a foot in the air with surprise, and about three boys to the left and three boys to the right also jumped a foot in the air with surprise. For a moment we hardly knew which of us was getting the hiding. Then, as the teacher laid it on a bit harder, I knew that I was the unlucky one. He continued his beating, muttering all the time, "Lama's favorite pampered idiot, I'll teach you to learn something." The dust rose from my robe in a choking cloud and started me sneezing. For some reason, that enraged the teacher even more, and he really worked up into knocking more dust out of me. Fortunately, unknown to him, I had anticipated his bad mood and had put on more clothes than usual, so, although he would not have been pleased to know it, his blows did not disturb me unduly. In any case, I was hardened. This teacher was tyrannical. He was a perfectionist without being perfect himself. Not only did we have to be word-perfect in our lesson work, but if the pronunciation, the inflection, was not exactly to his desire, he would take out his cane, whip round to the back, and then whip us on our backs. Now he was getting some exercise, and I was nearly suffocating with the dust. Small boys in Tibet, like small boys everywhere, roll in the dust when they fight or when they play. And small boys, completely cut off from all feminine influence, do not always make sure that the dust is out of their clothing. Mine was full of dust, and this really was as good as a spring clean. The teacher went on thwacking away. "I'll teach you to mispronounce a word, showing disrespect to the sacred knowledge, pampered idiot, always missing classes and then coming back and knowing more than the ones that I've taught. Useless brat, I'll teach you. You'll learn from me one way or another." In Tibet, we sit on the floor, cross-legged. Most times we sit on cushions, which are about 4 inches thick. And in front of us we have tables, which may be from 12 to 18 inches from the ground, depending on the size of the student. This teacher suddenly put his hand forcibly on the back of my head and pushed my head down onto my table, where I had a slate and a few books. Having me in a suitable position, he took a deep breath and really got busy. I wriggled just from habit, not because I was being hurt, because in spite of his most earnest endeavors, we boys were toughened. We were almost literally tanned into leather, And things like this were just an everyday occurrence. Some boy made a soft chuckle 6 or 7 boys away to the right. The teacher dropped me as if I had suddenly glowed red hot and leapt like a tiger onto the other boy. I was careful to betray no indication of my own amusement when I saw a cloud of dust arising a few boys down the line. There were various exclamations of pain, fright, and horror from my right, because the teacher was hitting out indiscriminately, not being at all sure which boy it was. At last, out of breath and no doubt feeling a lot better, the teacher stopped his exertions. "Ah," he gasped, "that will teach you little horrors to pay attention to what I'm saying. Now, Lobsang Rampa, start again and make sure that you get the pronunciation perfect." I commenced all over again, and when I thought about a thing, I really could do it well enough. This time I thought, and then I thought again, so there were no more hard feelings from the teacher and harder wax on me. For the whole of that session, 5 hours in all, the teacher paraded backwards and forwards, keeping a very sharp eye indeed upon us all, and no provocation at all was needed for him to lash out and catch some unlucky boy just when he thought he was unobserved. In Tibet, we have our day starting at midnight. It starts then with the service, and, of course, there are regular services at regular intervals. Then we have to do menial work in order that we may be kept humble, in order that we shall not look down on the domestic staff. We also have a period of rest, and after that we go to our classes. These classes last 5 hours non-stop, and during that whole time the teachers were indeed making us learn thoroughly. Our classes, of course, lasted more than 5 hours a day, but this particular session, the afternoon session, lasted 5 hours. The hours dragged by. It seemed that we'd been in that classroom for days. The shadows seemed scarcely to move, and the sun overhead seemed as if rooted to one spot. We sighed in exasperation and with boredom. We felt that one of the gods should come down and remove this particular teacher from our midst, for he was the worst of them all, apparently forgetting that once, oh, so long ago, he too had been young. But at last the conches sounded, and high above us on the roof a trumpet blared forth, echoing across the valley, sending an echo back from the patala. With a sigh, the teacher said, "Well, I am afraid that I have to let you boys go now, but believe me, when I see you again, I shall make sure that you have learned something." He gave a sigh and motioned toward the door. The boys in the row nearest jumped to their feet and really bolted for it. I was just going as well, but he called me back. "You, Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, you go away to your guide, and you learn things, but don't come back here showing up the boys that I have taught. You are being taught by hypnotism and other methods. I am going to see if I cannot get you kicked out." He gave me a cuff to the side of the head and continued, "Now get out of my sight. I hate the sight of you here. Other people are complaining that you are learning more than the boys whom I teach." As soon as he let go of my collar, I bolted too, and did not even bother to shut the door behind me. He bawled out something, but I was traveling too fast to go back. Outside, some of the other boys were waiting, well out of earshot of the teacher, of course. "We ought to do something about that one," said the boy. "Yes," said another, "somebody's going to really get hurt if he goes unchecked like that." "You, Lobsang," said a third boy, "you are always boasting about your teacher and guide. Why don't you say something about the way we are ill-treated?" I thought about it, and it seemed to me to be a good idea, for we had to learn. But there was no reason why we should be taught with such brutality. The more I thought about it, the more pleasant it seemed. I would go to my guide and tell him how we were treated, and he would go down and put a spell on this teacher and turn him into a toad or something like that. "Yes," I exclaimed, "I'll go right now." And with that, I turned and ran off. I hastened along the familiar corridors, ascending up, and so that I got nearer the roof. At last I turned into the lama's corridor and found that my guide was already in his room with the door open. He bade me enter and said, "Why, Lobsang, you're in a state of excitement. Have you been made an abbot or something?" I looked at him rather ruefully and said, "Honorable Lama, why are we boys so ill-treated in class?" My guide looked at me quite seriously and said, "But how have you been treated badly, Lobsang? Sit down and tell me what it is that's worrying you so much." I sat down and commenced my sad recital. During the time I was speaking, my guide made no comment, made no interruption whatever. He allowed me my say, and at last reached the end of my tale of woe and almost the end of my breath. "Lobsang," said my guide, "does it occur to you that life itself is just a school?" "A school?" I looked at him as if he had suddenly taken leave of his senses. I could not have been more surprised if he had told me that the sun had retired and the moon had taken over. "Honorable Lama," I said in astonishment, "did you say that life was a school?" "Most certainly I did, Lobsang. Rest a while, let us have tea, and then we will talk." The attendant who was summoned soon brought us tea and enjoyable things to eat. My guide partook of food very sparingly indeed. As he once said, I ate enough to keep about four of him. But he said it with such a twinkling smile that there was no offense implied or taken. He often teased me, and I knew that he would never, under any consideration, say anything that would hurt another person. I really did not mind in the least what he said to me, knowing how well he meant it. We sat and had our tea, and then my guide wrote a little note and gave it to the attendant to deliver to another Lama. Lobsang, I have said that you and I will not be at temple service this evening, for we have much to discuss. And although temple services are very essential things, so, in view of your special circumstances, is it necessary to give you more tuition than average? He rose to his feet and walked across the window. I scrambled to my feet, too, and went across to join him, for it was one of my pleasures to look out and see all that was happening, for my guide had one of the higher rooms at the Jagpuri, a room from which one could look out over wide spaces and see for long distances. Besides, he had that most enjoyable of all things, a telescope. The hours I spent with that instrument, the hours I spent looking away across the plain of Lhasa, looking at the traders in the city itself, and watching the ladies of Lhasa going about their business, shopping, visiting, and just, as I put it, plain wasting time. For 10 or 15 minutes we stood there, looking out, and then my guide said, "Let us sit down again, Lobsang, and discuss this matter about school, shall we?" "I want you to listen to me, Lobsang, for this is a matter which you should have clear from the start. If you do not fully understand what I say, then stop me immediately, for it is essential that you do understand all this. You hear?" I nodded to him, and then, as a matter of politeness, said, "Yes, Honorable Lama, I hear you, and I understand. If I do not understand, I will tell you." He nodded and said, "Life is like a school. When we are beyond this life in the astral world, before we come down into a woman's body, we discuss with others what we are going to learn. Some time ago, I told you a story about old Seng, the Chinaman. I told you that we would use a Chinese name because you, being you, would try to associate any Tibetan name with the Tibetan of your acquaintance. Let us say that old Seng, who died and saw all his past, decided that he had certain lessons to learn. Then the people who were helping him would look about to find parents, or rather, prospective parents, who were living in the circumstances and in the conditions that would enable the soul which had been old Seng to learn the desired lessons." My guide looked at me and said, "It is much the same as a boy who is going to become a monk. If he wants to become a medical monk, he comes to the Jagpuri. If he wants to do, perhaps, domestic work, then, no doubt, he can get into the Patala, for they always seem to have a shortage of domestic monks there. We choose our school according to what we want to learn." I nodded, because that was quite clear to me. My own parents had made arrangements for me to get into the Jagpuri, provided I had the necessary staying power to pass the initial test of endurance. My guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, continued, "A person who is going to be born already has everything arranged. the person is going to come down and be born of a certain woman who lives in a certain district and who is married to a certain class of man. It is thought that that will give the baby to be born the opportunities for gaining the experience and knowledge previously planned. Eventually, in the fullness of time, the baby is born. First, the baby has to learn to feed. It has to learn how to control certain parts of its physical body. It has to learn how to speak and how to listen. At first, you know, a baby cannot focus its eyes. It has to learn how to see. It is a school. He looked at me and there was a smile on his face as he said, "None of us like school. Some of us have to come, but others do not have to come. We plan to come, not for karma, but to learn other things." The baby grows up and becomes a boy and then goes to a classroom where he often gets treated rather roughly by his teacher. But there's nothing wrong in that, Lobsang. No one has ever been harmed by discipline. Discipline is the difference between an army and a rabble. You cannot have a cultured man unless that man has been disciplined. Many times now, you will think that you are ill-treated, that the teacher is harsh and cruel. But whatever you think now, you particularly arrange to come to this earth in these conditions. "Well, Honorable Lama," I exclaimed excitedly, "if I arrange to come down here, then I think that I should have my brains examined. And if I arrange to come down here, why do I know nothing at all about it?" My guide looked at me and laughed outright. "I know just how you feel, Lobsang," he replied, "but really, there is nothing that you should worry about. You came to this earth first to learn certain things. Then, having learned those certain things, you're going out into the greater world beyond our borders to learn other things. The way will not be easy, but you will succeed in the end, and I do not want you to be despondent. Every person, no matter his station in life, has come down to earth from the astral planes in order that he may learn, and in learning, progress. You will agree with me, Lobsang, that if you want to progress in the Lamasery, you study and pass examinations. You would not think much of a boy who is suddenly placed over you and by favoritism alone became a laman or an abbot. So long as there are proper examinations, then, you know that you are not going to be passed over at some superior person's whim or fancies or favoritism." I could see that too, yes, when it was explained, it was quite a simple matter. "We come to earth to learn lessons, and no matter how hard nor how bitter the lessons which we learn on this earth, they are lessons for which we have enrolled before we came here. When we leave this earth, we have our vacation for a time in the other world, and then, if we want to make progress, we move on. We may return to this earth under different conditions, or we may move on to a completely different stage of existence. often when we are in school, we think that there's going to be no end to the day. We think that there is going to be no end to the harshness of the teacher. Life on earth is like that. If everything went smoothly for us, if we had everything that we wanted, we should not be learning a lesson. We should just be drifting along on the stream of life. It's a sad fact that we only learn with pain and suffering. "Well then, Honorable Lama," I said, "why is it that some boys and some lamas too have such an easy time? It always appears to me that I get hardships, bad prophecies, and beatings up by an irritable teacher when I really have done my best." But Lobsang, some of these people who apparently are very self-satisfied, are you sure that they are so self-satisfied? Are you sure that conditions are so easy for them after all? Until you know what they had planned to do before they came to Earth, you are not in a position to judge. Every person coming to this Earth comes with a prepared plan, a plan of what they want to learn, what they propose to do, and what they aspire to be when they leave this earth after sojourning in its school. And you say that you tried really hard at class today? Are you sure? Were you not rather complacent, thinking that you knew all there was to know about the lesson? Did you not, by your rather superior attitude, make the teacher feel rather bad? He looked at me somewhat accusingly, and I felt my cheeks grow somewhat red. Yes, he really knew something. My guide had the most unhappy knack of putting his hand on a spot which was tender. Yes, I had been complacent. I had thought that this time the teacher would not be able to find the slightest fault with me. My own superior attitude had, of course, in no small measure, contributed toward the exasperation of that teacher. I nodded in agreement. "Yes, Honorable Lama, I am as much to blame as anyone." My guide looked at me and smiled and nodded in approval. "Later, Lobsang, you will be going to Chongqing in China, as you know," said the Lama Mingyar Dondup. I nodded dumbly, not liking even to think of the time when I should have to leave. He continued, "Before you leave Tibet, we shall send to various colleges and universities for details about their instruction. We shall receive all particulars, and we shall then decide which college or university will offer you exactly the type of training which you will need in this life. In a similar manner, before a person in the astral world even thinks of coming down to Earth, he weighs up what he proposes to do, what he wants to learn, and what he finally wants to achieve. Then, as I've already told you, suitable parents are discovered. That is the same as looking for a suitable school." The more I thought about this school idea, the more I disliked it. "Honorable Lama," I said, "why do some people have so much illness, so much misfortune? What does that teach them?" my guide said, "But you must remember that a person who comes down to this world has much to learn. It is not just a matter of learning to carve, not just a matter of learning a language or reciting from sacred books. The person has to learn things which are going to be of use in the astral world after leaving the earth. As I've told you, this is the world of illusion, and it is extremely well suited to teach us hardship, and in suffering hardship, we should learn to understand the difficulties and the problems of others." I thought about all this, and it seemed that we had got onto a very big subject. My guide obviously got my thoughts, for he said, "Yes, the night is coming upon us. It is time to end our discussion for this night, for we have much to do yet. I have to go across to the peak, as we called the Patala, and I want to take you with me. You will be there all night and all tomorrow. Tomorrow we can discuss this matter again, but go now and put on a clean robe and bring a spare with you." He rose to his feet and left the room. I hesitated but for a moment, and that because I was in a daze. And then I hurried off to array myself in my best and to get my second best as my spare. Together we jogged down the mountain road and into the Mani Laking, just as we passed the Pargo Kaling, or Western Gate. There was a sudden loud squall behind me that almost lifted me from my saddle. "Oh, holy medical Lama!" yelled a feminine voice just to the side of the road. My guide looked about him and dismounted. Knowing my own uncertainties on a pony, he motioned for me to remain seated, a concession which filled me with gratitude. "Yes, madam, what is it?" asked my guide in kind tones. There was a sudden blur of movement, and a woman flung herself to the ground at his feet. "Oh, holy medical Lama," she said breathlessly, "my husband could not beget a normal son, the misbegotten son of a she-goat." Dumbly, stunned at her own audacity, she held out a small bundle. My guide stooped down from his great height and looked. "But, madam," he remarked, "why do you blame your husband for your ailing child?" "Because that ill-favored man was always running around with loose women. All he thinks about is the opposite sex, and then, when we get married, he cannot even father a normal child." To my dismay, she started weeping, and her tears ran down to hit the ground with little plops, just like hailstones, I thought, coming down from the mountains. My guide looked about him, peering somewhat in the increasing darkness. A figure by the side of the Pargo Kaling detached himself from the darker shadows and moved forward, a man in a ragged dress and wearing a definitely hangdog expression. My guide beckoned to him, and he came forward and knelt on the ground at the feet of the Lama Mingyur Dhanda. My guide looked at both of them and said, "You do not right to blame each other for a mishap of birth. For this is not a matter which occurred between you, but is a matter to do with karma. He looked at the child again, pulling aside the wrappings in which the baby was swaddled. He looked hard, and I knew that he was looking at the infant's aura. Then he stood up, saying, "Madam, your child can be cured. His cure is well within our abilities. Why did you not bring him to us earlier?" The poor woman dropped to her knees again and hastily passed the child to her husband, who took it as if it might explode at any moment. The woman clasped her hands and looked at my guide, saying, "Holy medical Lama, who would pay attention to us? For we come from the Ragyab, and we are not in favor with some of the other Lamas. We could not come, Holy Lama, no matter how urgent our need." I thought all this was ridiculous. The Ragyab, or Disposers of the Dead, who lived in the southeast corner of Lhasa, were as essential as any other in our community. I knew that because my guide was always stressing that no matter what a person did, that person was still a useful member of the community. I remember once laughing heartily when he said, "Even burglars, Lobsang, are useful people, for without burglars there would be no need of policemen. Hence burglars provide policemen with employment." But these Ragyab, many people looked down upon them, thinking they were unclean because they dealt with the dead, cutting up dead bodies so that the vultures would eat the scattered pieces. I knew, and felt as my guide, that they did good work, for much of Lhasa was so rocky, so stony, that graves could not be dug, and even if they could, normally Tibet was so cold that the bodies would just freeze and would not decay and be absorbed into the ground. "Madam," commanded my guide, "you shall bring this child to me in person 3 days from now, and we shall do our utmost to see that he is cured, for from this brief examination it appears that he can be cured." He fumbled in his saddlebag and produced a piece of parchment. Quickly he wrote a message upon it and handed it to the woman. "Bring that to me at the Chakpori, and the attendant will see that you are admitted. I shall inform the gatekeeper that you are coming, and you will have no difficulty whatever. Rest assured, we are all humans in the sight of our gods. You have nothing to fear with us." He turned and looked at the husband. "You should remain loyal to your wife." He looked at the wife and added, "You should not abuse your husband so much. Perhaps if you were kinder to him, he would not go elsewhere for solace. Now go to your home, and in 3 days from now, return here to the Chakpori, and I will see you and assist you. That is my promise." He mounted his pony again, and we rode off. Diminishing in the distance were the sounds of praises and thanks from the man of Ragyab and his wife. "I suppose, for tonight at least," Lobsang, "they will be in accord. They will be feeling kindly disposed towards each other." He gave a short laugh and led the way up to the road to the left just before we reached the village of Sho. I really was amazed at this, which was one of my first sights of husband and wife. "Holy Lama," I exclaimed, "I do not understand why these people came together if they do not like each other. Why should that be?" My guide smiled at me as he replied, "You are now calling me Holy Lama. Do you think you are a peasant? As for your question, well, we're going to discuss all that on the morrow. Tonight we're too busy. Tomorrow we will discuss these things, and I will try to set your mind at rest, for it is sorely confused." Together we rode up the hill. I always like to look back down on the village of Sho, and I wondered what would happen if I tossed a good-sized pebble onto a roof or two. Would it go through, or would the clatter bring someone out thinking that the devils were dropping something on them? I never actually dared drop a stone down because I didn't want it to go through the roof and through someone inside. However, I was always sorely tempted. In the Patala, we mounted the endless ladders, not stairways, ladders, which were well worn and steep, and at last we reached our apartments high above the ordinary monk, above the storehouses. The Lama, Mingyar Dandap, went to his own room and I went to mine, which was adjoining. By virtue of my guide's position, and by being his chela, I had been allowed this room. Now I went to the window, and, was my wont, I looked out. Below us there was some night bird calling to its mate in the willow grove. The moon was bright now, and I could see this bird, see the ripples of water as its long legs stirred up water and mud. From somewhere in the quite near distance there came the answering call of a bird. "At least that husband and wife seem to be in harmony," I thought to myself. Soon it was time to go to sleep, for I had to attend the midnight service, and already I was so tired that I thought that possibly in the morning I could oversleep. In the afternoon of the next day, the Lama Mingyar Dandap came into my room while I was studying an old book. "Come in with me, Lobsang," he said. "I have just returned from a talk with the Inmost One, and now we have to discuss problems which are puzzling you." He turned and led the way into his own room. Sitting in front of him, I thought of all the things that were on my mind. "Sir," I said, "why are people who marry so unfriendly to each other? I looked at the aura of those two Ragyab last night, and it seemed to me that they really hated each other. If they hated each other, why did they marry?" The Lama looked really sad for a few moments, and then he said, "People forget, Lobsang, that they come down to this earth in order to learn lessons. Before a person is born, while a person is still on the other side of life, arrangements are being made deciding what sort, what type of marriage partner will be chosen. You should understand that a lot of people get married in what one might term the heat of passion. When passion spends itself, then the newness, the strangeness, wears off, and familiarity breeds contempt. Familiarity breeds contempt. I thought about it, and obviously, people got married in order that the race might continue, but why could not people get together the same as animals did? I raised my head and asked that question of my guide. He looked at me and said, "Why, Love Sang, you surprise me. You should know as well as anyone that the so-called animals often mate for life. Many animals mate for life. Many birds mate for life. Certainly the more evolved ones do. If people got together, as you say, just for the purpose of increasing the race, then the resulting children would be almost soulless people. The same, in fact, as those creatures who are born by what is known as artificial insemination. There must be love in intercourse. There must be love between the parents if the best type of child is to be born. Otherwise, it's as much the same as just a factory-made article." This business of husband and wife really puzzled me. I thought of my own parents. My mother had been a domineering woman, and my father had been really harsh to us, his children. I could not summon up much filial affection when I thought of either my mother or my father. I said to my guide, "But why do people get married in the heat of passion? Why do they not get married as a business proposition?" "Love Sang," said my guide, "that is often the way of the Chinese and of the Japanese, too. Their marriages are often arranged, and I must admit that Chinese and Japanese marriages are far, far more successful than marriages in the Western world. The Chinese themselves liken it to a kettle. They do not marry in passion because, they say, it's like a kettle boiling and cooling off. They marry coolly and allow the mythical kettle to come up to the boil, and in that way it stays hot longer." He looked at me to see if I was following, to see if the matter was clear to me. "But I cannot see, sir, why people are so unhappy together." "Love Sang, people come to Earth as to a classroom. They come to learn things. And if the average husband and wife were ideally happy together, then they would not learn, for there would be nothing to learn. They come to this earth to be together and to get on together. That is part of the lesson. They have to learn to give and to take. People have rough edges or idiosyncrasies which jar and grate on the other person. The grating partner must learn to subdue and perhaps end the annoying trait, while the partner who is annoyed must learn tolerance and forbearance. Almost any couple could live together successfully, provided they learn this matter of give and take." "Sir," I said, "how would husband and wife be advised to live together?" "Husband and wife," Lop Sang, "should wait for a favorable moment, and should then, kindly, courteously, and calmly, say what is causing them distress. If a husband and wife would discuss things together, then they would be more happy in their marriage. I thought about this and I wondered how my father and my mother would get on if they tried to discuss anything together. To me, they seemed to be fire and water, with each one being as antipathetic to the other. My guide obviously knew what I was thinking, for he continued, "There must be some give and take, because if these people are going to learn anything at all, then they should be sufficiently aware to know that there is something wrong with them." "But how is it," I asked, "that one person falls in love with another or feels attracted to another? If they are attracted to each other at one stage, why do they so soon cool off?" Lob saying, "You will well know that if one sees the aura, one can tell about another person. The average person doesn't see the aura, but instead, many people have a feeling. They can say that they like this person or that they dislike that person. Most times they cannot say why they like or dislike, but they will agree that one person pleases them and another person displeases them." "Well, sir," I exclaimed, "how can they suddenly like a person and then suddenly dislike a person?" "When people are at a certain stage, when they feel that they are in love, their vibrations are increased, and it may well be that when these two people, some man and some woman, have heightened vibrations, they would be compatible. Unfortunately, they do not always let it remain heightened. The wife will become dowdy. Perhaps she'll refuse the husband what is undeniably his right. The husband will then go out after some other woman, and gradually they drift apart. Gradually their etheric vibrations will alter, so that they are no longer compatible, so that they are completely antipathetic." "Yes, I could see that, and it really did explain much, but now I have returned to the attack. Sir, I am most puzzled to know why a baby should live for perhaps a month and then die. What chance does that baby have of learning or paying back karma? It seems such a waste to everyone, so far as I can see." The Lama Mingyur Dondup smiles slightly at my vehemence. "No, love," saying, "nothing is wasted. You're being confused in your mind. You're assuming that a person lives for one life only. Let us take an example." He looked at me and then looked out the window for a moment, and I could see that he was thinking of those people of the Ragyab, thinking perhaps of their baby. "I want you to imagine that you are accompanying a person who is getting through a series of lives," said my guide. "The person has done rather badly in one life, and in later years that person decides that he cannot go on any longer. He decides that conditions are just too bad for him, so he puts an end to his life. He commits suicide. The person therefore died before he should have died. Every person is destined to live for a number of years, days, and hours. It is all arranged before they come down to this earth. If a person terminates his own life, perhaps 12 months before he would normally have died, then he has to come back and serve the additional 12 months. I looked at him and visualized some of the remarkable possibilities which could come from that. My guide continued, "A person ends his life. He remains in the astral world until an opportunity occurs where he can come down again to Earth under appropriate conditions and live out the time he has to serve on Earth. This man with 12 months, well, he may come down and be a sickly baby, and he will die while he is still a baby. In losing that baby, the parents will also have gained something. They will have lost the baby, but they will have gained experience. They will have paid back a little of what they had to pay back. We will agree that while people are on Earth, their outlook, their perceptions, their values, everything, are distorted. This, I repeat, is the world of illusion, the world of false values. And when people return to the greater world of the Overself, then they can see that the hard, senseless lessons and experiences undergone during this sojourn on Earth were not so senseless after all." I looked about me and thought of all the prophecies about me, prophecies of hardship, prophecies of torture, prophecies of sojourns in far and strange lands, I remarked. "Then a person who makes a prophecy is merely getting in touch with the source of information. If everything is arranged before one comes down to Earth, then is it possible, under certain conditions, to tap that knowledge?" "Yes, that is perfectly correct," said my guide. "But do not think that everything is laid out as inevitable. The basic lines are there. We are given certain problems, certain lines to follow, and then we are left to do the best we can. One person can make good and another person can fail. Look at it this way. Supposing two men are told that they have to go from here to Kalimpong in India. They do not have to follow the same path, but they have to arrive at the same destination if they can. One man will take one route and another will take the other. Depending upon the route which they take, so will their experiences and adventures be affected. That is like life. Our destination is known, but how we get to that destination remains within our own hands." As we were talking, a messenger appeared, and my guide, with a short word of explanation to me, followed the messenger down the corridor. I wandered again to the window and rested my elbows on the ledge, supporting my face in my hands. I thought of all that I'd been told, thought of all the experiences that I had had, and my whole being welled with love for that great man, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, my guide, who had shown me more love than my parents had ever shown me. I decided that no matter what the future would bring, I would always act and behave as if my guide were by my side, supervising my actions. Down in the fields below, monk musicians were practicing their music. There were various brumps, 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 and the squeaks and groans from their instruments. Idly, I looked at them. Music meant nothing to me, for I was tone deaf, but I saw that they were very earnest men, trying hard indeed to produce good music. I turned away, thinking that I would occupy myself once again with the book. Soon I tired of reading. I was unsettled. Experiences were tumbling upon me faster and faster. More and more idly I turned the pages. Then, with sudden resolution, I put all those printed sheets back between the carved wooden covers and tied the tapes. This was a book which had to be wrapped in silk. With inborn care I completed my task and set aside the book. Rising to my feet, I went to the window and looked out. The night was somewhat stuffy, still, with not a breath of wind. I turned and left the room. All was still, still with the quietness of a great building which was almost alive. Here, in the Patala, men had worked its sacred tasks for some centuries, and the building itself had developed life of its own. I hurried along to the end of the corridor and scaled the ladder there. Soon I emerged on the high roof by the side of the sacred tombs. Silently, I padded across to my accustomed spot, a spot which was well sheltered from the winds which normally raced down the mountains. Lying back against a sacred image, with my hands clasped at the back of my head, I stared out across the valley. Tiring of that after a time, I lay back and looked up at the stars. As I watched, I had the strangest impression that all those worlds above were wheeling around the Patala. For a time it made me feel quite dizzy, as if I were falling. As I watched, there was a thin tracery of light. Becoming brighter, it exploded into a sudden burst of brilliant light. Another comet finished, I thought, as it burned itself out and expired into a shower of dull red sparks. I became aware of an almost inaudible shush, shush, somewhere close by me. Cautiously I raised my head, wondering what it could be. By the faint starlight, I saw a hooded figure pacing backwards and forwards at the opposite side of the sacred tombs. I watched. The figure moved across to the wall facing the city of Lhasa. I saw the profile as he looked into the distance. The loneliest man in Tibet, I thought. The man with more cares and responsibilities than anyone else in the country. I heard a deep sigh and wondered if he too had had prophecies such as I. Carefully I rolled over and crawled silently away. I had no desire to intrude, even innocently, upon the private thoughts of another. Soon I regained the entrance and made my quiet way down to the sanctuary of my own room. Some 3 days later, I was present as my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, examined the child of the Ragyab couple. He undressed it and carefully viewed the aura. For some time he pondered upon the base of the brain. This baby did not cry or whimper, no matter what my guide did. As I knew, small as it was, it understood that the Lama Mingyar Dondup was trying to make it well. My guide at last stood up and said, "Well, Lobsang, we're going to get him cured. It is clear that he has an affliction caused by birth difficulties." The parents were waiting in a room near the entrance. I, as close to my guide as his shadow, went with him to see those people. As we entered, they prostrated themselves at the Lama's feet. Gently he spoke to them, "Your son can and will be cured. From our examination, it is clear that at the time of birth, he was dropped or knocked. That can be remedied. You need have no fear." The mother trembled as she replied, "Holy medical Lama, it is as you say. He came unexpectedly, suddenly, and was tumbled upon the floor. I was alone at the time." My guide nodded in sympathy and understanding. "Return at this hour tomorrow, and I am sure you will be able to take your child with you, cured." They were still bowing and prostrating themselves as we left the room. My guide made me examine the baby carefully. "Look, Lobsang, there is pressure here," he instructed. "This bone is pressing upon the cord. You observe how the auric light becomes fan-shaped instead of round." He took my hands in his and made me feel round the affected area. "I am going to reduce, to press out, the obstructing bone. Watch." Faster than I could see, he pressed his thumbs in, out. The baby made no outcry. It had been too fast for him to have felt pain. Now, though, the head was not lolling sideways as before, but was upright as a head should be. For some time, my guide massaged the child's neck, carefully from the head down towards the heart, and never in the opposite direction. On the following day, at the appointed hour, the parents returned and were almost delirious with joy at seeing the seeming miracle. "You have to pay for this," smiled the Lama Mingyar Dondup. "You have received good, therefore, you must pay good to each other. Do not quarrel nor be at variance with each other, for a child absorbs the attitudes of the parents. The child of unkind parents becomes unkind. The child of unhappy, loveless parents is unhappy and loveless in its turn. Pay by kindness and love to each other. We will call upon you to see the child in a week's time." He smiled and patted the baby's cheek and then turned and went out with me by his side. "Some of the very poor people are proud," Lobsang. "They are upset if they have not money with which to pay. Always make it possible for them to think they are paying." My guide smiled as he remarked, "I told them they must pay. That pleased them, for they thought in their best dress that they had so impressed me that I thought they were people with money. The only way they can pay is, as I said, by kindness to each other. Let a man and a woman keep their pride, their self-respect, love sang, and they will do anything you ask. Back in my own room, I picked up the telescope with which I had been playing. Extending the shining brass tubes, I peered in the direction of Lhasa. Two figures came quickly into focus, one carrying a baby. As I watched, the man put an arm around his wife's shoulder and kissed her. Silently, I put away the telescope and got on with my studies. End of chapter 10.